Om Namah Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namah Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namah Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Srimad Bhagavatam 7th Canto. We'll read from this chapter 14 entitled Ideal Family Life. Since everyone here is in such a situation. And the Bhagavatam discusses all aspects of society, all legitimate aspects of society, and all legitimate occupations. Sri Yudhisthira Vacha, Grihastha Etam Padavim, Virina Yena Chandrasa, Yaya Deva Rishe Bruhi, Madrasa Griha Murhadi. This is a king speaking to a sage. That is the normal thing in a real society, that the government administrators, they take advice from the saintly person. The government administrators, they are executors. They're like the arms, but the arms need a head to guide them. So in a real human civilization, there is a reciprocal arrangement between the head and the arms, between the brains of the society and the executors of society. Now you don't have that. There's no brain on top of society. Nor is it easy to find actual real administrators in the government. Everyone basically has the mentality of an ordinary laborer. By ordinary laborer mentality, we mean that they're not able to provide any benefit for society, and if they are not employed by some corporation or business or factory, they don't know what to do with themselves. But in Vedic civilization, it was recognized that there has to be a class of persons who are the brains of society. But they never take a salary, because as soon as they receive a salary for providing advice, they're bought off. That's what you have. This is the problem you have in government today. All the think tank persons, all the government advisors, all the university professors, they're all concerned about their salary and position. Therefore, their advice is always tainted, at the very least. And then the so-called government administrators, they don't know what it means to really be an administrator. The Vedic standard is that whoever is in the administrative sector, personally they take an interest in safeguarding the citizens. Personally, if there's some crime, if there's some disturbance, then the government administrators themselves personally go out and make a solution. Not that they sit behind their desks and send others, or when the nation is under attack, they just recruit any old kind of person and send them off to the war field to die. No. Those in the government posts, according to the Vedic standard, they display their prowess by personally protecting the people. Now, do you expect your Shipley to do that? Get out of the streets and clear the streets of crime personally? No. You wouldn't expect that, just as you wouldn't expect a man to give birth to a child. You wouldn't expect a woman to have it as her job to clear the streets of crime and physically protect the citizen. People are mixed up. They don't know what the purpose of government is. It's like now in New Zealand, they voted in the MMP system. Now they're saying, oh, it's not a good system. Look, it's caused so much confusion. No, the confusion is already there. The people don't know what the purpose of the government is, or what the qualifications of a real government leader are. So right from the very beginning of this chapter, we're getting insight into the real standard. The king, Yudhisthira, is inquiring of the sage. The sage's wealth is what? His university grants or his salary? No, the sage's wealth is his austerity. The Vedic saying is that austerity is the wealth of the Brahmins. Austerity is the wealth of the brain class. They don't want pay, they just want an unfettered chance to cultivate knowledge and to teach. They want to live simply because they have the brains to understand that everything in this world is temporary. They don't want to get entangled in so many complexities. And the administrators, recognizing here we have some bona fide advisors, they're ready to take the advice. Because they see the advisors have nothing to gain or lose in the situation. So, Maharaj Yudhisthira, he's the king, he's inquiring from Narada Muni, the sage. Oh my lord, oh great sage, kindly explain how we, who are staying at home without knowledge of the goal of life, may also easily attain liberation, according to the instructions of the Vedas. So, in the previous chapters, Prabhupada writes here, in the previous chapters, the great sage Narada has explained how a brahmachari, a vanaprastha, and a sannyasi should act. He first explained the dealings of a brahmachari, vanaprastha, and sannyasi, because these three ashramas, or statuses of life, are extremely important for fulfillment of the goal of life. One should, so everyone knows what brahmachari, vanaprastha, and sannyasa ashram. You know? Okay. There are four stages of Vedic social life. First, there is what's called brahmachari, celibate student. And then, after going through some years training as a student, living an austere life, the student can decide, generally late teens, early 20s, that's in classical Vedic civilization, he'll decide whether I feel I need to marry or not. If he decides to marry, he goes into what is called Grihastha Ashram. Ashram means a like a fortress, a stance you take up. Yes, a stance. You take up for your spiritual advancement. So the Vedic civilization gives you four basic stances. What would you do? In karate, you have some basic stances from which all the other moves are executed. Mm-hmm. What do you call them?
Those are just yoga stances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, the Vedic civilization gives you four basic stances you take up. But the purpose of all the stances is to fight illusion. It's not that if you take up the householder stance, okay, I can just forget about spiritual development. And no, all the stances have the same purpose. They're just different stances for your different inclinations at the time. So brahmachari, that means celibate student. Then if one decides to marry, you enter grihastha life, which means family life for the purpose of spiritual cultivation. After your career in family life, at the end of your years, the Vedic classical system is, given you have a lifespan of 100 years, which no one does these days, then the last 50 you spend in retirement. And the classical Vedic injunction is, panchas sorvam vanam vrajet. 50 years old means yellow light. That's it. Prepare for the red light. So, at 50 years old, according to the classical Vedic system, the husband and wife, they, you know, the kids are grown up, they just focus on preparing. For the final stage of life. And of course, the final stage of life is giving up this body. So, the higher sections of Vedic society the man would, in the higher sections, the man at the last stage, he would take sannyas, which means he would move even beyond family retirement. He would go away from the life and wander alone in the forest, preparing for death. So everything is devised scientifically. For what purpose? So that the living entity can disentangle himself from material existence. So Srila Prabhupada's point here is that first Narada Muni, the sage, explained to the king about brahmachari, vanaprastha, and sannyas. Because these three ashramas or stances are essential for society. In other words, the point is that family life, grihastha life, is not essential. The Vedic standpoint is actually it's not required, but because human beings have certain desires, okay, let's make a stance by which they can act out those desires in a regulated, licensed way. So, we read here. One should note that in the Brahmachari Ashram, Vanaprastha Ashram, and Sannyas Ashram, there is no scope for sex life, whereas sex is allowed in grihastha life under regulations. Narada Muni, therefore, first described brahmacharya, vanaprastha, and sannyas because he wanted to stress that sex is not at all necessary, although one who absolutely requires it is allowed to enter grihastha life or household life, which is also regulated by the shastras and guru. So, this is a very radical point for modern society today. Sex life is not at all necessary, not required. That is the Vedic vision. But it doesn't mean, okay, if you can't live with that, forget you. No. The Vedic system recognizes that. Many people, they'll, although theoretically even, they may understand that we're not this body. Still, they have this powerful inclination. So, all right, let's harness that inclination in a setting where it doesn't cause damage. Let's use it for a productive purpose. And what is that productive purpose? To bring into the world high-quality children who can benefit the general population. And while doing so, the husband and wife gradually become less attached to the male-female combination. And as they progress in the years after executing their family duties, they realize that this male-female taste is something you can outgrow in a constructive way. But of course, in your younger years, it's a very volatile time, so many people need to take up that stance so to keep themselves properly situated without capsizing. So in this way, the Vedic system, the social system is very scientific, taking into account all types of people. That's why in Vedic culture, which you don't find today, a man is allowed to have more than one wife because, what is the purpose of that? First of all, it's recognizing that because there are going to be a section of society of the males who choose not to marry, that means there's going to be women without husbands because there's not enough men around. So those men who have that inclination, they're allowed to accept more than one wife. Why? For the purpose of protecting and maintaining them. The whole purpose of Vedic society is to give protection, to give support. The whole purpose is not how to gratify my senses. That's what you have today, and that is animal society. The topmost meditation of everyone, whether they're government, whether they're professors, whether they're this or that, the whole point is how to gratify my senses. The whole purpose of Vedic civilization is how to give protection. Big difference. So Prabhupada writes here, one who absolutely requires it is allowed to enter grihastha life or household life, which is also regulated by the shastras and gurus. So there's proper spiritual procedures for every ashram or stance. There's proper spiritual procedures, how to be a family person, how to be a monk, how to be a student, and how to be a retired family person. There's procedures all laid down for that. A person who remains a householder in family life is certainly ignorant of life's goal. He is not very much advanced in intelligence. As soon as possible, one should give up his so-called comfortable life at home and prepare to undergo austerity or tapasya. According to the instructions given by Rishabhdev to his sons, we should not create a so-called comfortable situation, but must prepare to undergo austerity. This is how a human being should actually live to fulfill life's ultimate goal. So, actual spiritual household life means not how to make a big situation for comfort, how to be pampered, and how the wife should be a legal prostitute at home. That is not the purpose of Vedic household life. The purpose is how the husband and wife work together for spiritual realization. That makes the household life spiritually productive. That is the austerity of householders. How to keep Krishna in the center, in spite of all the pressing daily necessities, in spite of all the bodily urges, how to keep the goal of reviving love of God in the center of the family. And it's a battle, because things are always pushing. Oh, this is needed, that is needed, fix this, go here, do that. You're not talking to me enough, or you're talking to me too much, or I don't know how it goes. So how to keep... None of you know any of this. How to keep Krishna in the center of all this. This is the householder's austerity. And it is possible. But as soon as you think the purpose of family life is how to make my nice little soft castle where I'm pampered, then you have a relationship based on impossible expectations. And this is why you see marriage problems. If the spiritually inclined husband and wife have false expectations of what a marriage should be, then there's trouble. The problem with the male-female combination is that unless you proceed with knowledge, automatically, as soon as a man and woman come near one another, they generate all sorts of hallucinations, in case you haven't noticed. As soon as they come near one another, like a special vision just ignites, and they see things which actually aren't there, but they don't realize that till later. Reminds me of one song when I was very young. There were bells in the air, but I never heard them ringing till there was you. There were birds in the air, but I never heard them chirping till there was you. So that's the way it is when they first come together. Just their proximity generates a vision. Oh, I see it. I see it. Yes, yes. You see things you never thought you saw before. And after a while, you won't see them. You all are old hands, you know all this. We're talking not about ordinary materialistic family persons. I mean, they're completely out of it. But sometimes, even spiritually inclined or Krishna conscious inclined family persons, they unnecessarily have difficulty because they don't understand the man and woman have false expectations. Basically, the problem comes when the man and woman are expecting the other to be Krishna. You are supposed to supply all my dreams. You are supposed to be the embodiment of all my expectations. That's when the problems come. The woman wants certain things, the man wants certain things, and they all think the other is going to supply. You see the other person as your supply agent, like your own warehouse where everyone gets a bargain. My personal warehouse. And so you put all this on the other person. Basically, it comes down to what you're actually saying is, what are you going to do for me? What's your function in this world? How are you satisfying me? And when it doesn't happen, then you become full of anxiety. What's wrong with this relationship?
It's just not clicking like it used to. You're just not doing for me like you used to do. But in a Krishna conscious relationship, it is based on duty. You're running an enterprise. And what is the purpose of that business? You've gone into business together, and what's the purpose of the enterprise? How to become spiritually perfect. So that makes things completely different. You're trying, by the combination of the man and woman, you're trying to generate a profit. And what's the profit? We shall become spiritually advanced. Then things enter a totally different realm. Otherwise, there's always this exploitation, smeared over with lots of sugar. What are you doing for me? What are you doing for my senses? You never say that, but instead you say it in so many other complicated ways. I just don't think that you're caring for me enough. I just don't think that you really understand what I mean. And it just goes on and on and on, the negotiations, the dialogues, Now, what's the bottom line? What are you doing for my mind and senses? What's your purpose in life? Justify yourself to me. So if these false expectations are not there, then you can more clearly look at the situation. We have gone into business together to generate a profit. What's the profit? How to become Krishna conscious. There'll be good days, there'll be bad days, but the business is pushing forward. Then everything becomes quite clear. The man has certain things he brings to the business. The woman has certain things she brings to the business. That's what it's all about. That's why even in Western culture, romance is a recent development. Romance marriages in the past few hundred years. Even in Western culture. And in Asia, it's just a new development coming in due to Western movies and satellite TV. Everybody in the world knows you don't marry for romance. You marry because the man and woman are bringing certain things to the relationship, and man requires woman, woman requires man, so therefore they're establishing some kind of institution between the two. It's like in Japan, those who are coming from cultured families, they always tell the children, do not marry for romance. Marriage is not for romance. Now, for the average Western person to hear that, this is barbaric, this is cruel. In a cultured society, when a young man or young woman thinks, I've fallen in love, the parents tell them, this romance thing, it'll pass. It's not what you should base your life on. When you have a practical understanding of what the man and woman are supposed to bring to the table in a relationship, then you can begin to make some progress. And what is the purpose of that coming together? It is not sense gratification. It is how to mutually aid one another in spiritual development. Then things start to click. Otherwise, it's just a constant hassle. You didn't do this. You didn't do that. You didn't tell me. You didn't speak to me. You didn't. I did. No. Day after day after day. After a while, they just get so disgusted that these days they have a divorce, if they're married, the drop of a hat. And they think, there'll be someone else who won't put me through all that anxiety. Forget it. Naturally, even in the best Krishna conscious relationships, there's always a little commotion because you have duality, male body, female body. Like Srila Prabhupada once said, there's a Bengali proverb, when there's a bunch of kitchen utensils together, there's always going to be a little noise. So, there's always going to be a little commotion. Because male and female, they are opposite poles. They're different, like hot, cold, pleasure, pain, sweet, sour. So there's always going to be some misunderstanding, even in the best spiritually focused relationships. But in the Vedic system, arguments between husband and wife are never taken seriously. the example given is that in the morning, the husband is angry. I've had enough of this. I'm leaving. The wife says, no, I'm leaving first. You don't have to go. By evening, it's all forgotten. After the evening meal, it's all forgotten. That's the Vedic standard. The Vedic injunction is that arguments between husband and wife are to be taken no more seriously than you take if little boys are fighting. Same thing. You don't take it seriously. It just happens, and then it's like sometimes your sons, they fight. Dennis and Robin's sons, they fight, and you don't get into a whole, oh, why are they fighting? Oh, let's really try to understand the cause. This is very devastating. They're fighting. Oh, our life is ruined. No, you know, little boys, they tussle and over no apparent reason. They're little boys, and they'll forget about the reason in 5 minutes. So that's the Vedic way you're supposed to view arguments between husband and wife. Same thing. That is only possible when you have a higher goal than sense gratification. Otherwise, if your goal is sense gratification, you can't tolerate any disturbance in that department. Oh, you've lost the loving feeling. What's wrong? The thrill of our relationship is gone. Oh, no. But if the purpose of the relationship is how to assist one another in spiritual development, becoming Krishna conscious, then you're looking for something else completely. You're not putting all these unnecessary, improper expectations on one another. What do you expect out of a body of matter? What do you expect out of a mind of matter? You think that's really going to satisfy you? Better you go to the closet, your closet, and you know, grab hold of a jacket and say, what are you going to do for me? The potency to satisfy you is not there in someone's body or mind. So as soon as you start to understand that, you stop trying to bug the other person. Yeah. Otherwise, you're always trying to take your partner and like put them in a juicer and get something out of them. And it's an extraordinary stress you put the other person under. The other person has to constantly justify his or her existence to you. You're constantly analyzing. Do you really care for me? The women, they want full commitment. They want to see that you are focusing on me. They want to feel that. And the man basically doesn't want to be bothered by that all the time. The man, he wants, the materialistic man, he wants the woman around when he wants her around. When he doesn't want her around, he doesn't want her around. And the woman, she doesn't like that. She figures, if I'm yours, then I'm around you all the time. Don't just pick me up and put me down like I'm a toy. I want the full concentration in every moment. As soon as the full concentration slackens, the women start to freak out. What are you doing? Where have you been? What's going on? They have to feel that full beam constantly. And the man, you know, he can't handle that after a while. Come on, I told you 10 times I love you. Come on, I'm doing this for you, I'm doing that for you. Can't you see that's enough? Just don't bug me. Leave me alone. He says like that until he starts feeling his desires. Then it's, oh, I've been today. And the woman says, aha, now you come around. So it's just like a constant stitch two things together, which actually should not be together for material purposes. But you're constantly striving in that way. You read so many books about relationships. How to have the perfect relationship, how to understand him, how to understand her. What is the purpose of all that if you're simply trying just to enjoy your senses and have children to teach them to do the same thing? That's the greatest crime, to perpetuate the illusion by having children who are raised in the same crazy way. So there is an art how the man and woman associate for the purpose of spiritual development. It doesn't mean they neglect their home. It doesn't mean they neglect their jobs or their necessities. They do it dutifully, but they don't have their hearts bound up in it. Their heart is for their spiritual development. So, Yudhisthira Maharaj, the king, he's actually an extraordinary devotee of Krishna, but he's out of humility, he's presenting himself like an ordinary householder person. He's saying to the sage, "Oh great sage, oh my lord, kindly explain how we who are staying at home without knowledge of the goal of life may easily attain liberation." Now certainly, Yudhisthira Maharaj, the king, is not an ordinary householder without knowledge of the ultimate goal of life, but he's presenting himself in that way. That's one of the qualities of spiritual advancement. You never think, "Oh, I have attained this degree, I have attained this belt." No, you're always thinking, I actually have no knowledge. So the sage is now replying. Narada Muni replied, "My dear king, those who stay at home as householders must act to earn their livelihood. And instead of trying to enjoy the results of their work themselves, they should offer these results to Krishna, Vasudev. How to satisfy Vasudev, Krishna, in this life can be perfectly understood through the association of great devotees of the Lord." So the sage is telling the king that, yes, you must earn your livelihood. Those who stay at home as householders must act to earn their livelihood. But they should not work just to accumulate benefits and comforts for themselves. They should offer the fruits of their activity to Krishna. How do you do that? By making Krishna the center of your home, by supporting activities of teaching others about Krishna consciousness. That is the duty of the householder. A householder should have all the spiritual props and paraphernalia and books, etc., that are needed. That's proper spending. Every home should have a full set of Srila Prabhupada's books. They are the actual treasure, the spiritual encyclopedias. You may not read them all at once, but just knowing they're there in the home gives you a proper anchor. And the householder is not callous to the sufferings of others. Therefore, the householder is concerned, how can we help distribute the mercy of Krishna to others because they're suffering in ignorance so badly? So in other words, the householder is not simply working for his own maintenance. That's when things get very boring and dry, very selfish. No, here we read that the householder, instead of trying to enjoy the results of their work themselves, they should offer these results to Krishna. And you learn that science of how to do that by association with devotees of Krishna. You learn how Krishna is the center of your home, how to do that. So now Rumuni goes on to say, "A grihastha must associate again and again with saintly persons, and with great respect, he must hear the nectar of the activities of the Supreme Lord and his incarnations, as these activities are described in Srimad Bhagavatam and other Puranas. Thus, one should gradually become detached from affection for his wife and children, exactly like a man awakening from a dream." That's the perfect result of Vedic family life. As you near your 50s, you start to realize, even though I've been keeping Krishna in the center of my home, and even though I've been working hard to have a proper spiritual family life, as I'm nearing 50 now, I start to realize this is not completely necessary. Of course, when you're in the turbulence of your 20s, you're not expected to see all that. But as the whole, if you properly engaged in Krishna conscious family, as you start to near 50, you start to realize, well, actually, you know, it's not absolutely necessary what I did, but anyway, I did it, and so let me go about it dutifully, but You know, it's not essentially required. In other words, you start to wake up from a dream. I thought when I was in my 20s I had to have this. Now I see, you know, these things pass. My youth is gone. My kids, they've grown up. passions are dying down. I see, all this was just like a storm that appeared and then went away. So that's the proper goal. This is a classical Vedic civilization. But the problem is we don't have such a civilization today. In classical Vedic civilization, just like Prabhupada in his youth, which was the early 20th century, he said when his sister reached 12 and she wasn't married, his mother told her husband, Srila Prabhupada's father, that if this girl is not married right away, I'm going to commit suicide. Because that's the Vedic system. That when, as the girl is attaining puberty, she's already matched, so she knows she has someone in the future. They generally didn't start living together until the girl was 16. But she knew, I don't have to shop around. She's not in anxiety. I have someone. And the psychology of a female who's been properly raised is that the first one she gives her heart to, that's where it stays. These things are impossible. So, the girl is married when she's 12. The man is anywhere from 5 to 10 years older. So, therefore, they're having children when they're young, so then by the time the man is 50, his kids are grown up. The daughters are married, the men are all off in their occupations. And because the man generally has been trained as a celibate student, he has control of his senses. He just doesn't get married and just lose himself and treat the wife like a legal prostitute at home. But what's happening nowadays? Nowadays everyone has the realization. The men have the realization. Why work so hard keeping a cow at home, so much trouble keeping your own cow? Milk is easily available everywhere. So the men think, why should we go to so much trouble maintaining a wife at home? Sex life is available everywhere. Let's not be bothered by the institution of marriage. Like we were talking to our friend last night. Why won't he marry you? She wouldn't say, but we know why he won't marry. He said, what do I need to marry her for? I'm getting all the benefits right now without any responsibility. Let it go on like this. And of course, the men, they make up so many excuses. Well, you know, marriage is not necessary. You know, I mean, the main thing is our love and all. It's better this way. It's more real. They make up all these things. And for a while, the women accept it. But not for long. Because the female nature is she wants security. And she looks to the man for security. So many men and women found that out during the hippie days. When there was just free love. But by the time the hippies, man and woman, they reached their 25th or 26th year, all of a sudden, you know, the girl is turning to the young man and saying, oh, by the way, when are you going to get a job? Well, I thought we were hippies. Now, look, if we're going to have a relationship into the future, you know, we're going to need an income. We're countercultural. We're alternative. That's the way it goes. How do they usually say it? One couple there now, devotees, they were telling me how it works. The girl said to the, you know, to the young man, when are we going to get a job? Meaning, when are you going to get a job? When are we going to get a job? A job? Come on. I mean, you know, we've had such a wonderful free love relationship, traveling here and there, going to different countries, just the bliss of irresponsibility. You're pushing me to get a job? Yeah, so I mean, you have to really think about the future. And the man is shocked. Future? I thought we just, day after day and night, we just have our affair and, you know, you satisfied with that? So So the whole point of the Vedic family system is that you take responsibility for your decisions. Not that, well, I married you, but today I don't like you. No. You take responsibility for your decision. And that way you become purified. Thus one should gradually become detached from affection for his wife and children, exactly like a man awakening from a dream. That's what happens if you've executed your family life properly. And by association with saintly persons, you hear Srimad Bhagavatam, the nectar of Krishna's activities and qualities. That's your life and soul. So Narada Muni, he's a sage, but he's going to give you practical advice now. While working to earn his livelihood as much as necessary to maintain body and soul together, one who is actually learned should live in human society unattached to family affairs, although externally appearing very much attached. So you're satisfied with the necessities that you need. You work. You certainly work. As a family person, you have to work, but just enough to maintain the minimum standard. And one who is actually learned should live in human society unattached to family affairs, although externally appearing very much attached. So you're actually executing all your duties responsibly, but it's not like your heart is completely absorbed in it. No, your heart is for something else. But you do execute your responsibilities. An intelligent man in human society should make his own program of activities very simple. If there are suggestions from his friends, children, parents, brothers, or anyone else, he should externally agree, saying, yes, that is all right. But internally, he should be determined not to create a cumbersome life in which the purpose of life will not be fulfilled. So any questions about this?
Not so much about that, but you were talking about the government. The government and that we should follow the laws of the land as well as the laws of God. If the laws of the land are run by demons,
where did you read that? Follow the laws of man.
I can't remember, but I did hear it. I know I heard it.
I
read it from a long time ago, but
not exactly like that.
Not so much in those words, but
right.
You should obey. I mean, like feeding and things like that.
I don't. He would not talk in that way. He always explained things very philosophically. That we follow the laws of society because if we don't, it causes a great disturbance for our ability to teach Krishna consciousness to others.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, we recognize that everyone who is not accepting the law of God, they are criminals. So how can criminals actually establish law?
Mm-hmm.
But although we know that internally, externally, we follow them. Because otherwise it will be a great disturbance. If you just march into a bank, for example, say everything belongs to Krishna, give it all to me, it will not be very good for people's opinion of Krishna consciousness. So, it's not that we have veneration or any kind of profound respect for the laws of the land. We just recognize a practical necessity. These laws have been established by persons who have no idea what karma is. They don't really know what real law is. But because we are in this situation, out of practicality, and we follow them, but it's not that we find any deep value in them. For all these laws, they're allowing prostitution, they're allowing slaughterhouses, they're allowing intoxication, gambling. That's what the laws are doing. Any other questions? So that's a good example of how to externally accept something without internally ascribing it or giving it great value.
My niche, I feel so comfortable here. It's so fulfilling to me. This is my man. And the man's not feeling, you know, my woman. No, they are practical. We've gone into business together, setting up this family life, and it's for a purpose. And we're assisting the mother in achieving the goal of the business. Most people, man needs woman needs man, so let's have Krishna as the center of the relationship, and then gradually we'll wake up from this kind of dream and we'll realize we actually don't even need it. So the Vedic system is a progressive march towards that goal. Not that, oh, you're 20 years old and you're feeling bodily desires, oh, forget you, there's no place. No. There's a whole system how to go through that. But it's very difficult to establish these days because society is so polluted. But we have to start somewhere. So, I guess we'll start with you all. You all can demonstrate the ideal family life. So what do you think, Sharon? It sounds okay?
A lot of different ways of looking at things, isn't it?
What do you mean?
People before me realize, what food can you eat? Most people are just, such gnawing, food gnawing.
And then you just burn each other out, and then you don't want to be around the person. Before you're saying, she's mine, now you say, I don't want that. Without any higher purpose for the relationship, it can't last. Because, the romance fades, the bodily beauty fades. But a real affection can develop based on mutual duties in assisting one another's spiritual realization. That's real affection. You think it's not possible, but it is. You actually appreciate the person in a genuine way because you know this person has my spiritual enlightenment at heart. And that is real affection. Otherwise, why shouldn't the man go riding off on his motorcycle and why shouldn't he? What can you really do for him? And what can he do for you? And then actually, the men, they sometimes, even materialistic men, they realize, what can I actually do for her? I'm just using her. Better I just go off. But with Krishna in the center of the family, then you realize we are together to assist one another in our spiritual development. This life is temporary, our bodies are temporary, but let's use it for the best purpose, making the best use of a bad bargain. The body is temporary, therefore it's a bad bargain. You've got two temporary bodies together, and what's their purpose? Let's make the best use of it. Let's have them assist one another in realizing they're not the body. Any other questions? Bobby, you have any questions?
No, that sounds well to me.
Bobby?
Yes. Well, I think it's
apparently.
So, we want you all to build a nice family community here, enclave. Take your time. Don't rush yourselves. What do I mean by that? It's a fact we're all going to die. We can die at any moment. Therefore, in one sense, you should live every day like it's your last. But in families, you have to keep that in mind at the same time. At least make a plan for progressive development. This is the bind in family life. Yes, you can go at any minute, you can die any moment, but still, you can't have a family acting that way. That's the advantage of the other ashramas, brahmachari, vanaprastha sannyas. You can live every day as if it's your last. Live every day like you're going to die tomorrow. But in family life, you can't do that. You have to keep that in mind. I mean, death is no respecter of what ashram you're in. Oh, you're a family person. I can't touch you. No, death can grab anyone at any moment. But still, a family person has to keep that reality in mind while making some progressive plan over the years. That's just the way it is. So therefore, I'm advising you all, have a steady plan for spiritual development. Don't be shooting stars. There's no pressure that you've got to, you know, get your belt in 6 months, you know? No. That, I don't recommend that at all. You've got to get your belt right now. You've got to, you know, the next belt and No. Find your footing. Get the basic stances down, the basic katas, and gradually, things will start to click. There's no fanaticism, there's no I gotta do this right away. The main thing is you're chanting Hare Krishna. That you should do right away. And then everything will come together around that. I think Dennis and Robin have seen that. They basically started chanting Hare Krishna. And around the sound vibration of Krishna's name, everything started to develop. So if you want to be fanatical or hasty about something, then chant Hare Krishna. The other things are circumstances that will gradually come together around the holy name. So please don't feel any pressure that, I'm joining some organization, I immediately have to do this and that. It's not like that at all. You're talking about your individual spiritual progress. Krishna consciousness is a network of spiritually dedicated persons who are trying to put Krishna in the center. So you find your footing first. Sometimes in the beginning, the husband's more interested than the wife, or the wife's more interested than the husband, or the husband and the wife are interested, but the kids aren't into it. There's so many things you have to balance. Sometimes even the kids are into it, and the parents aren't into it. So, go about things with a cool head. And if you want to feel that there's a urgent need, which there is, you chant Hare Krishna. That's the urgent need. So that's my advice I give at the dojo. The Krishna conscious dojo. You just find your footing first. No artificial going for the belts, Take your time while chanting Hare Krishna. I don't say take your time in chanting. That's what Dennis would say. I was on his case. I'll see how much I chant. But I didn't bug you anything else, did I? I always ask Bhakti Siddhanta Swami before he's speaking very enthusiastically about Dennis and Robin. Yeah, well, how much they chant? That was the only thing I stressed. You got to get together right away. Because I knew that they understood the value of discipline.
and sense control, so why not use that to chant Hare Krishna? So I knew if they weren't chanting with full measure that actually they were just kidding themselves. So we want to create some stability, a stable situation. Families require stability. They require a mutual awareness of each of the expectations, what the man expects from the woman, what the woman expects from the man. And they always have to keep reminding one another what the goal is. Otherwise, the man has his ways, he goes off the path, and the woman has her ways, she goes off the path. Huh? So you're all very fortunate to have spouses who are genuinely spiritually dedicated. So take advantage of this good fortune. Find out what the real purpose of a spouse is, not just a partner in sense dedication, but a partner in spiritual enlightenment. And be an example for others. So remember, once again, you have to find your footing, have to have a firm stance, stability, as much as possible in this world, which is getting pretty crazy right now. I was just telling the people in Wellington. So you read about 2,000 people dying in Papua New Guinea from tidal waves. What makes you think that won't, something like that can't happen here? You're thinking, oh, Wellington is very nicely built up and organized. Nature would never do that.
How do you know?
You think nature discriminates between some grass huts on the remote coastline of Papua New Guinea and Wellington? Yeah. The three tidal waves in the night, they came at night. One, they said, was 10 meters high. What is so righteous and wonderful about the living entities' activities in Wellington that such things would not happen? What are they doing that's so great there that makes them immune? So these are tumultuous times. You will see society get its reactions for openly sponsoring such horrible activities. You'll see the reactions come. So, still though, a householder has to think of stability, even in the most unstable times. This is the way it is. So you all should make some stability together and show a wonderful example. And we're seeing, even in a small town like Cardigan, so many nice persons are coming out of the woodwork. For a while, Dennis was thinking, oh, I guess it's just going to be me. I mean, it's just the way it is. So many nice people are there who want to see what is Krishna consciousness. And as family persons, you're right, you're very nicely situated, you can teach them. Because you see, although they may like to hear from monks, you know, sannyasis, or swami, they know, I can't live like that person. So therefore they can just say, well, that means it's not practical, it's not possible, so let me just stay in my materialistic life. So when they see families, then they can relate to that. Yeah. I know what the girls are thinking in the back of their minds who were here yesterday. They're thinking, well, wouldn't I just like to have a nice relationship where someone cared about my spiritual advancement? You know, and what about this guy up there? He's just using me. And, you know, if it has to be that way, look at these people. I mean, they have husbands, wives, and they look like they really care about them. There's something different. That's what they're thinking. So you want people to think that way. Alright. So please keep that in mind. Just keep the basics. Keep it simple. Keep it stable. Stress the chanting. If you're inclined to study the books, if you have a philosophical mind, you read the books. Even if you don't have a philosophical mind, I recommend at least read one book. No one book. Bhagavad Gita, Krishna book, or something. Are you a reader, Sharon?
Yes, sir.
Then you read all the books. If you're a reader, read all the books. If you're not, at least read one book. And you, Robbie, are you a reader? Okay. Get full sets of all the books. Just dive in.
That's what I'm still working on.
Yeah. Why waste your time and money on a Harley when you have Srimad Bhagavatam, Akhilakam Chaitanya Charitamrita? You won't just have those books on your shelf, and your wife will be happy knowing you're just sitting there reading them. I hear that even Dennis and Robin, as busy as they are, they have the three reading periods a day. I heard rumors or something like that. Fun, huh? Brain development. Yes. Brain development. Krishna consciousness, it's for the simplest child, and it's also for the most brilliant genius. As Robbie was saying yesterday, it's like the more you scratch, the more you find it's there under the surface. Yeah, you can just go deeper and deeper and deeper. It's for the simplest child, like your son, and it's for the Einsteins of this world. That's the extraordinary thing about it. So you all do have good intelligence. New Zealanders are a bit different, I think. They don't know it themselves, but actually, compared to other people in the world, I've been on every continent, I know New Zealanders are a bit nimble-minded. So therefore, they should use that gift to study the Krishna conscious books and be very happy. Okay, Hare Krishna.